sirve la utopía? Pues a caminar.
Vete conmigo, amigo, hablar y caminar, porque el camino se hace al andar. Vete conmigo, amigo, hablar y caminar, porque el camino se hace al andar.
Bueno, amigo Marcos, ¿cómo estás?
Aquí estamos.
Welcome to the audience, to Al Andar, our little grown-up show and tell. I'm Jim. I'm joined by Marcos. Today, I want to share Everything Is Now. Everything Is Now is my first attempt at making a short film. It's a little over 2 minutes. And I want to, before I share it with you, Brother Marcos, and the audience, I want to talk briefly about the film and super briefly about filmmaking. This is a new area for me. I do have an MFA, which is a master's in fine arts. So that means that that for me, stories are really important. I think stories are how we experience the world. Right, we have a beginning, we have a middle, we have an end. Right, subjectively as humans, and we tell ourselves things about what these experiences mean. And so I've always been very passionate about stories. Stories have a special way of speaking to me, and I think to all of us, in ways that are more powerful than, you know, just a set of facts. And anyway, I really wanted to explore filmmaking, partly because of exploring YouTube and thinking about what kind of content I want to make, and given my passion for stories and my interest in creating video content, I decided to kind of bridge together those two ideas, and now I'm very excited to experiment with filmmaking. Everything Is Now is my first short film. I'm actually working on another one right now that explores at least one of the big ideas in the film a little bit more in depth. This idea about free will or the lack thereof, also known as determinism, which is a philosophical idea that I have some interest in. We can talk about more of that later on. But for now, I guess I'll just super briefly introduce the clip that we're about to watch. Once again, it is called Everything Is Now. That is the title. You can watch it on YouTube and on TikTok. what's interesting, Marcos, is that when I shared it on TikTok, I got more views than I usually get. And when I saw it, when I shared it on YouTube, it got very few views. So I just thought that that was pretty funny, how different the view count was.
Yeah, I was surprised when I, because yeah, I saw it on TikTok and then you shared the YouTube link.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's definitely my experience, you know, too, generally.
I guess I'm glad that I shared it on both, because if I had only shared it on YouTube, for example, and it got a few views, then I might think that, well, maybe this isn't that good. Not that I think that one should value their art very strongly based on view count, for example. I don't think that those two things necessarily match up very well. And we've talked about, you know, things that are popular that we're not super into as artists. Okay, so not to get derailed, let's watch the short film. It's a bit shy of 3 minutes, and there is some narration, voiceover, and video elements that, well, for the listener, I will describe, but I do encourage you to watch it. It is an audiovisual experience. But just imagine a car driving along a road. And from the view of a dash cam, for example, and switching between like the front view and the back view, where you don't see the driver, you don't even see the car, right? You just see movement. Everything is now.
Movement. It's perhaps the most quintessential element of the human condition. You move from one location to another throughout life. Home, school, work, dates, meetings, vacations, retirement, funerals. When you should, when you want, when you must. You move to in time, like a time traveler, from the past to the present, from the present to the future, from birth to adolescence to old age. One way, like Gatsby, unable to go back. Notice how one thought leads into another. Try to stop it. Try thinking your last thought. Hold on to that precise mental moment for as long as you can. No interruption. I'll wait. Okay, you move. What's the point? The point is that you are not, as intuition hints, a driver going along a road. You are the car. And the story is movement. A drive. Even when you stop going forward or backward, when you are idle, still you move. Otherwise, you are dead. Without this knowledge, you look ahead for yourself, but see only what you have yet to traverse. And when you look back, again, you fail to see yourself. The perceived continuity between the past or the future with the present puts you in contrast with whom you are, which is neither, and both. You are not an identity, but a process. As such, you are not one thing, but things moving together to make the thing you recognize as you, the thing of things, move. You are kaleidoscopic. The universe looking back at itself. You are everything. And everything is now. Movement from movement from movement from movement from movement.
Yeah, Brother Margo, so without me saying much more about the film than I already have, what are some things that kind of caught your attention? Very curious how you perceived the film and what elements of it stayed with you and made you think about things.
Yeah. Well, first of all, congratulations. My first reaction was, this is dope. And I like, you know, you can kind of tell when you're watching something just because your friend made it, you know, and I was like, oh, yeah, I'd want to be watching this if I didn't know that dude doing the voiceover. And I was. Yeah, I found the sound and visual textures are really engaging, and the narration explains a relationship between them, you know, but there's the element of tension is part of what's interesting about it.
Can you talk a bit more about that?
Well, the music is somewhat spooky, right? But also driving, right? Rhythmic. And it's night driving, right? And there's a lack of mooring in the driving. We don't have a sense of beginning, middle, and end just from the visuals. And so that, you know, all this stuff, it's in counterpoint with the text. It supports the text, but it supports it in a way that gives a more, that's enriching, right? So it gives us a sense of some of the emotion that's related to these ideas for the narrator.
I think that's very perceptive. Yeah. Absolutely. Especially the comment about the movement, right? It begins on movement and it ends on movement. And that's very much intentional. It's a longer clip that I got where there is kind of this, at the end, the guy kind of just parks the car and whatever. I think it's like a fast food chain. It's like, right in front. It looks a little weird. But I'll talk more about movement. I just want to give you a chance to just state whatever your first impression is, and then maybe we can talk about some of the bigger ideas I was trying to drive at in the film.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so I think I had three distinct experiences watching it. The first time when I saw it on TikTok, I was like, well, this looks well made and engaging, and is it just a car commercial? in the end, right? Yeah. And so the key point in that listen for me was the shift where the narration argues, okay, you move, what's the point? Reading from the script now, the point is that you are not, as intuition hints, and the visuals up to this point hint, a driver going along a road, you are the car. And the story is movement. So that was a really, that was an important, that was the key shift the first time I watched it, to understanding what you're doing with the ideas and the visuals. When I read it, it was interesting just to notice the stuff that's not the text, you know, what do you call it? In theater, you'd call it stage direction. What do you call it in mm-hmm. film?
Sort of the action, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the action description and the sort of camera work, you know, description. And when I watched it just now, I noticed maybe why it had this emotional charge or poignancy to me in noticing I like that it's a pretty typical, and that is to say, in a sense, unremarkable suburban scape, that of North American suburban scape that is being traversed, right? And I think there's a sort of stoic that seems right to me, because it would kind of be not really be that supportive of people's real experience of life if it was like a journey to the beach, or if it was, you know, a journey from the mountain to the shore, or vice versa, or something like that, you know? Yeah, those are the three distinct experiences I've had with it.
Whippa, as you say. I'm not used to saying
as you say. Whippa. As you Islanders.
I'm just not used to it. I'm stealing your expression a little bit.
I like the 2020s sincere yet kind of ironic Weppa, like there's this a primary journalist behind the series La Brega, always podcast series La Brega, always like, I think her sign off is like Weppa. It's not quite that. It's not sarcastic. It's like Weppa. I don't know. I can't do her Weppa, but you know, it's all good. We can journey and find our own Weppa. And that, pero gracias.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for those reflections, and I got some interesting comments on TikTok, and I'm grateful that my content, even if it doesn't always get a decent number of views in accordance with what I'm used to, I do find that I do usually get some a good amount of comments. There's something about my content that kind of people want to respond to, or it makes them think, and so I'm really happy that happens, because I am certainly trying to make that happen. I think a lot about things, as you know, and you do too. And we joke around that, you know, we have this little group, we call ourselves the Bronx Overthinker Society. We overthink things. So we like to think about things. So yes, please comment and share your reflections. A lot of people seem to have gotten at least the movement piece, the movement idea. So right now I'm going to talk about two big ideas, big in the context of the film, two big ideas or themes in the film, and this should frame the conversation that we're about to have. So the two ideas are dynamism, which has to do with movement, and determinism, which, as I mentioned in the intro, has to do with free will, a certain perspective about free will. So let's start talking about the first thing, which is dynamism. It begins with the sentence. So I kind of broke it up into two. I'm playing around a little bit with punctuation. This is something that is intentional. It's creative in the context of creative writing. So it's movement, period. It's perhaps the most quintessential element of the human condition. So right there, I put special emphasis on the word movement, because it's an important idea in this film. And then I say, and I hedge a little bit, right? I say perhaps, but I say it's perhaps the most quintessential element of the human condition. So I think there's something fundamental about movement. And you know, certainly this is not a new idea. Shakespeare wrote a lot about this flux, this state of change that comes to define the human condition. I want to talk a little bit more about movement and then why I think this is an important idea, okay? And then give you some time to respond to these ideas. So what do I mean by movement is like a fundamental part of what it means to be human? I start out by talking about physical movement, right? Because it's the most tangible, it's the most obvious. So I say, you move from one location to another throughout life. And then I give some examples of where people go throughout their lives in kind of a structured way. If you pay attention to these examples, they have themselves a kind of story within them. Home, school, work, dates, meetings, vacations, retirement, funerals. It kind of, you know, to the best of my abilities, when I wrote that, shows kind of the human story a little bit. And then I talk about time. You move to in time, like a time traveler, from the past to the present, from the present to the future, from birth to adolescence to old age. And here, you know, this is slightly more abstract. This is the idea of moving through time. And as I mentioned in the beginning, it is a story, right? We have a beginning, we have a middle and an end. The next part about Gatsby hints at why I think this is important, right? I say one way, like Gatsby, unable to go back. For anyone who's read the story, I think it's a great story. I teach it in, I assign The Great Gatsby as a book in one of my courses. I think it's a great story. But anyone familiar with the story knows that Gatsby, like his big existential hangup, if you will, is that he desires to, like a time traveler, re-experience the past, right? He can't let it go. And he wants to kind of recreate it. I think the recent Leonardo DiCaprio film did a good job at being more explicit in that, because there are a few lines in that film where that's made explicit. So Nick Carraway says something like, you know, you can't relive the past. And Gatsby says, of course you can. Of course you can. Hmm. And that is, you know, the fatal flaw. So super briefly, let me just talk about two other things that connect to the idea of movement. There was a section that I took out. Okay, so I'd like to read the section that I took out. It reads as follows. And there is internal movement. Your cells constantly renew. About 330 billion cells daily. About 1% of you. Over the course of 100 days or so, you are essentially a new you. And that, I guess, makes the idea even more more real to me, because you also change physically, like what your body composition is. And then the last analogy has to do with our mental lives. Our mental lives are in constant flux, right? And that's why I give this small little challenge, you know, try to stop the idea of one thought leading into another. So I say, try thinking your last thought. Hold on to that precise mental moment for as long as you can. No interruption, I'll wait. And anybody who's tried mindful meditation knows that you can't stop yourself from thinking. But you can sort of quiet down all of the attentional distractions, I guess. So with all of that said, why do I think dynamism is so important? Why do I think that this part of the human condition is so important? I think that we cause a lot of harm to ourselves when we, there's a further line, there's a line further down in the script. I guess I can read that too. But it's harmful when we search for the continuity, for us to be the same. It's a little bit counterintuitive, the idea of movement, because I think that most of us see ourselves as sort of a static identity acting in the world. And us in the past are us in the past, and us in the future is us in the future. And really, I think that that notion is incorrect. I think that you should expect yourself to change throughout your life. And some people can feel this, right? They know that when you look at your life 10, 15 years ago, especially if you are in your 30s or older, you notice there's a, usually you notice there's a significant change. And I think that that's healthy for you to look back 10, 15 years and be like, that was embarrassing, right? Because it shows growth and learning. And I think that expecting to identify with your past self or even your future self can be very harmful because of that. And the lines are, the perceived continuity between the past or the future with the present puts you in contrast with whom you are, which is neither and both. You are not an identity, but a process. And so that's kind of what I was getting at there, how harmful this idea of being an identity, being static, being sort of one thing per se. And I'm trying to show why I think that is bad. Hopefully motivating people to see sort of the continuity within their own lives and how they are changing in all of these different ways, and to understand that that's a healthy, normal thing and something they should aspire toward. Yeah, that was a bit of a monologue. Sorry, but I would love to hear what you think about some of those ideas and give you a chance to respond.
Wepa, it's a rich text, and it's richer. The combination of elements is richer. So there's a lot to enjoy.
Thank you.
So let me say, some of the text I didn't understand the way you, or I just didn't understand till you explained it. Not much of it, just kind of I wasn't that aware of the structure. And so you say my last analogy as an introductory phrase, right? I think that's how you're using it. I heard it as, anyhow, you were cueing what was coming next. I thought you were, when I heard it, I thought you were saying the last thing I used as an analogy.
Yes, that's it.
Is how you intend it? Okay.
Yeah. Can I just briefly explain?
Go ahead. Yeah.
So in the script, there are...
Because you're writing the way people talk, right? Yes. Which I like.
Right.
And then when you... but when you hold that... When you compare that to how the punctuation is conventionally understood to signify. You know, there's a bit of a tension.
Right. So maybe part of the reason why there was some confusion on my use of that phrase, my last analogy, for both of us, is that it was originally in the script and I took it out. It begins the, let's see, what stanza is this? 1, 2, 3, 4 on the script that you have. It should be 4th stanza. In the film, it says, I think it begins with, notice, for example, how one thought leads into another. But when I originally wrote that and recorded it, I think I said, my last analogy, notice how, dot, dot, dot. And the reason I wrote that is that originally I had this stanza in here about so-called internal movement, right? The bit about the cells constantly renewing. So because I was doing all of these analogies, I thought, you know, I'm trying to picture somebody sort of hearing all of this vague, mystic-ish sounding stuff and thinking, like, what's the point? So anyway, it's just like you said, a conversational piece to kind of try to ground some of the mystical and the practical. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, sorry. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And so I think the activity of the work in a constructive way, in a generative way, is giving a context, maybe therapeutic context, for finding meaning in finding meaning for contemporary people, for the potential audience, right? And what you don't say in the text, though, I'm increasingly noticing, I'm increasingly noticing in the film, what you don't say, the text is kind of a therapeutic or pastoral philosopher, right? Caretaking philosopher response to some profound alienations that are routine for a lot of contemporary people, and that the film evokes, right? So two examples of that I'm noticing are, well, we're not cars, right? You know, and you're right. And so that's an interesting intervention, because in a significant sense, what cars do, and generally what technology sold for private profit to consumers, to privatize consumers over the last 100 years in particular, especially since the automobile, it's been about removing movement from our lives. That's what the tech is selling, and cars do that more than any other single technology, perhaps. I have a dissident point of view where I think we should call them sedentarians rather than mobiles at all. They're wheelchairs. They are expensive, climate catastrophe causing wheelchairs. And we didn't need them also. So that's, but that, and that's the second, that's the, relates to the second alienation, that the built environment that we in many cases, in most contexts outside of New York City, you need, and in some parts of New York City, even, most contexts in the United States, outside of New York City, to be a non-marginalized person, and to just be, have like a stable living, you need to navigate the world with a car, right? With a sedentary machine wheelchair. And what you're navigating creates this crisis of narrative and meaning. A lot of it's, a lot of it, to the extent that it's structured, is structured monstrously. It's like, for me, I think it's pretty clear that rebuilding cities to serve cars was never should have been at least a publicly supported policy, and that our cities were much more humane and wouldn't have been bringing upon us this climate catastrophe, at least for not another 50 or 100 years, if we just built up our cities for walking and mass transit, right? So I think there's that, the movement that we're doing is that one alienation is that it's like, you're just doing it to survive, but you're destroying the planet as you do it. It's sociopathic. And then there's this lack of narrative in the movement, also, right? I think this is hard to avoid anywhere, that the sense of place in most places, subject to neoliberalism, subject to economies being, governments intervening so that economies will be planned by corporate profit motives, it thins out the sense of place very dramatically and gives you this overwhelming sense of placelessness. Right? Like if this, yeah, so a journey from one Arby's to the next, or from one Starbucks to the next, we're presented with that as prosperity. But it ain't by itself abundant life. It ain't by itself meaningful. So your text, in a sense, is an intervention to help with, or at least a response to those problems, for to help at least a person not go crazy under those which are, to me, crazy making conditions.
Wow. Very insightful ideas, and you know, and I appreciate sort of the different perspectives you helped me to see. I didn't have a political angle to it, but I think a lot of what you said makes sense. And there's an obvious contradiction in the idea that, and I've noticed this especially with myself, that I use cars as the metaphor, because it's an obvious metaphor. When you think of movement, cars, if not the first thing that pops into your mind, or a close second. I also use cars because it's a very good visual for me to use for my ends. Given that I was trying to make a film, and I want to get good footage, and cars seem like a good way to do that, to show this idea of movement. We're kind of thrust upon the world. By the way, as I said earlier, our mental lives are movement, and I'm really focusing, especially in my second film, more on that mental experience. We're kind of thrust into the world, and consciousness is kind of infinite. I'm being a bit poetic here with language, but there's always a now, right? And even with like unconsciousness or sleeping or death, the experience, whenever there's an experiencing self, there's a now. Nevertheless, I think it's a funny contradiction that you expose that. I use cars, but cars are largely deleterious to our health because of the sedentary nature it engenders, right? It creates. And yeah, I notice this a lot because I commute about an hour or so, and you know, it just hurts, like my back hurts sitting on the seat. Mm. and you know, making the same drive over and over again, it's pretty tedious. And I've expressed before how you're kind of to you before, how it's kind of like being in a bubble, you know, like in a
mm-hmm.
Very metaphorical, but kind of in a real sense, because like you're surrounded by, you know, the see-through panels as if you were in a bubble, and the air is not really, you know, like you kind of have your own air if you just, you know, if you press the whatever that button is called in the car, and you can have your own music, and you are in a real sense in your own bubble. Yeah, I would agree with you that what is harmful is the societal and environmental impacts of cars. I think, you know, at the same time, there is some positive aspects of cars, which is, you know, the amount of movement that we can make on a individual level. It does provide for a certain amount of freedom, of course, as I'm sure, you know, you're thinking of right now, because I know how wrong I am in this sense. It's like that because it's made to be like that. And I think it's the lack of choice that's really harmful. But
yes, absolutely.
Cool. So,
well, and can I, if go ahead and finish your thought, but I want to make sort of make a bright side comment if I can.
Cool. Make your bright side comment, and then we'll move on to the second big idea, the last big idea in the film.
Yeah. So I do feel this social critique, and well, okay. Two quick thoughts. One, I don't think you don't completely escape it by having a routine where you walk. You know, you still have this sense of you're in motion, but you sort of feel a lack of journey, you know, what if you're always making the same walk, you know? And so that is sort of a discrete problem. And it's beautiful how, in spite of this, well, this bubble effect certainly creates that cars have, you know, certainly creates some negative personal and social responses. And it's beautiful how humans do have the capacity to find meaning in solitude. You know, and so, yeah, I affirm and respect Like that, I've heard multiple songwriters and several that I admire a lot say, yeah, I mostly compose in my head when I'm driving, you know? Right. Yeah. And it's kind of parallel to that, like Charles Dickens would compose in his head on long walks, you know,
and Darwin would do a lot of thinking, pacing around.
Well, we can create that space. We can find that space in a number of ways. And I think one of the reasons why these visuals are very powerful with these ideas, because like, you know, I don't spend much time in a Christian meditation labyrinth or in a Zen rock garden, you know, but I understand how people sometimes have an experience of flow while driving. You know, people can get to that. This is one context where people do manage to get to that sort of meditative place. Go ahead.
I was just going to very briefly state that I experience this. I drive and I like to occasionally not listen to anything. I'm very used to like putting on a podcast, but there are some drives where I really just want to be alone with my thoughts and I won't listen to anything. And I will have some really interesting thoughts. And it's just, it's kind of meditative in a way because, like mindful meditation, because it's, because you're focused on driving, it kind of allows like a freedom of this, stream of consciousness that would otherwise be too distracted to be, so focused. So, it's like, mindful meditation.
Yeah. Word. That, and I think that's a really important level of empathy that I think I want to have for what meaning that people need, you know, and nowadays are often finding maybe only in their cars, you know, only in those quiet spaces driving alone.
Yeah.
With no traffic. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to the second big idea in the film, and that is philosophical determinism. Determinism is the idea philosophically that there is no free will. There is disagreement about this idea among...
just in case anyone thought the conversation was bleak.
Okay, well...
We're going to put on a happy face. Go ahead, Brother Jim.
Yeah, that's hilarious. But I think we disagree about, I don't know if that was only a joke or if that is your perspective, but we disagree a little bit on what, maybe not what it means, but what it means to us individually for meaning.
Go ahead.
Okay. So there is disagreement about what determinism means. You know, I recently watched a debate between Robert Sapolsky, who believes in determinism, and Dan Dennett, who is a compatibilist, to renowned scholars, and the compatibilist view, as described by Dennett, sees indeterminism, this kind of metaphysical claim that like free will is metaphysical. The compatibilists like Dan Dennett believe that that this is not what free will is. Dennett and other compatibilists tend to define free will as kind of control or agency, the idea that, you know, you choose what you do. you make choices, you make decisions, you have an agency. If a rock rolls down a hill, that's one thing. If there's a skier going down a snowy hill, the latter has kind of free will. They can sort of turn, they can adjust to, you know, the fall, if you will. So I'm more on the Sapolsky side of defining free will. I think that I think the way he responds to Dennett's claim is very good, and I'll just briefly state that. And I'm saying all of this because it's in the film, and we'll briefly talk about why I think this is important, but just as some context, like what these words mean. Okay. So Sapolsky will say something like, yes, you make choices, but that's sort of like reading, you know, the last three pages of a book. Like, how did you make that choice? Where did that choice come from? And he's a biologist, so he talks about the biological sort of precursors to, you know, why you make the decisions that you make. There's nature and there's nurture fundamentally, and so the determinist view is basically that, you know, it's sort of like Sam Harris makes this analogy, so I'll use this analogy real quick. There was a shooter. This happened in the 60s. Charles Whitman, and long story short, he did a terrible thing, but it turns out that he had a brain tumor. Mm-hmm. He was writing letters explaining sort of like, something's wrong with me, I'm having all of these thoughts, and you know, when I die, please look at my brain, I don't understand what's happening. Mm-hmm. Right? So there couldn't be a better example of somebody who does something like this, of someone's free will, as Dennett would see it, being taken away. It's very obvious. But I think that's what Sapolsky says, right? It's like, it's obvious, but it's more obvious, but the other cases are less obvious. So Sam Harris will say something like, so that is explained by a tumor, but he essentially thinks that it's tumors all the way down. Meaning that it's metaphorical language, right? But it does sound funny. It's another version of that. It determined causes preceding that, and determined causes preceding that. So that is not as brief as I hoped, but that is essentially what determinism is. That is more or less what I believe. So where does this appear in the script? There are a few lines that kind of hint to it. And so the first time this is hinted at is during the second part of the narration or of the film. You know, I say, okay, you move, what's the point? The point is that you are not, as intuition hints, a driver going along a road. You are the car. This phrase is really important because, on the one hand, it's a little bit stolen, right? Sam Harris, neuroscientist, uses the analogy of, what does he say? You are not a traveler along a river. You are the river, right? To talk about this sense of self. And that metaphor itself, I think, is partly motivated by a famous book, short book called "On Having No Head," by I believe he was an English philosopher, mystic person, Harding, and he. he wrote an article describing the experience of having no head. I mention this because my next film will be more explicitly about this topic. But try to imagine looking back at your own face, right? Think about what you are seeing now, and think about where your eyes are. Right? You obviously cannot see your eyes or your face. So the experience of headlessness is that, right? You see hands floating about, you see your legs, you see your torso. But in some sense, it's an illusion, because what you really are is not that these things are not part of you, but the experiencing self, consciousness, is free and it's infinite and it is not, it is a movie as opposed to an actor playing a role. There's another line here in the film that goes, "You are kaleidoscopic," meaning multifaceted. The universe looking back at itself. That's in reference to those ideas. So it's also the fact that you are a part of everything. You're a conscious element of the universe. Again, this is determinism, because determinism is a materialist view of the universe. Finally, there is a play on words here at the very end where I say movement from movement from movement, dot, dot, dot. Notice it doesn't end. Notice the action in the film never ends. It's in constant movement. This has to do with determinism as well, because determinism tells us that that movement comes from movement, but there is a natural problem there, right? Because either that means that the universe is infinite, because where did that movement come from? You know, then where did that movement come from? And so on. Meaning, you know, if we are made up of nature and nurture, where does that come from? You go back to the evolution of life. You go back further. You look at molecules, and you go back further, and you look at atoms, etc. So it's either infinite, so turtles all the way down, or in Sam Harris's case, tumors all the way down, or it has some sort of beginning, and that beginning kind of comes out of nothing. I don't know that anybody claims to know what the answer to all of that is. People have faith and people have beliefs, etc. But these are natural philosophical problems. But that last line, movement from movement from movement, is about that. So why do I talk about these ideas? I think that, contrary to what someone like Dan Dennett says, right, which is something like, well, we want people to act responsibly. We want, if people do something good, we want them to take responsibility. If they do something bad, likewise. Two things about that. One, it's more about what I think and how that connects to what some determinists think. But that's not in the film, and then something that is more or less in the film. Firstly, many determinists agree in acting instrumentally with regards to free will, meaning just because you're a determinist doesn't mean that you think that people are not responsible for their actions. If someone, this is an example that Sapolsky uses, if your child is sick, you know, you take them out of school so that they don't infect everyone. But you don't, you're not shaming them, right? You're not saying you're a bad person because you got sick and blah, 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 blah. You know that that is not an expression of their free will. They didn't free will themselves into getting sick, and but nevertheless, you have to take action to prevent harm from happening. What is in the film is that I think that some ideas of free will are harmful, such as the idea of blame, ego, treating people unfairly. Sapolsky uses examples of the from the past. We used to burn witches because we thought that they were responsible for making people sick or crops failing, etc. And as time has moved forward, as we've progressed, we've expressed fewer and fewer ideas of this sort of, I think Dennett calls it a medieval perspective on free will, right? There's a big disagreement on with those two. So there is a line here that says something like, let's see.
Can I say one that, just point to one?
Oh, okay, yes.
There's a tremendous amount of ethos of individual versus the world that's justified by the notion that that's how freedom happens, you know? And I think, yeah, and that narrative is often situated in the United States inside of a car. And so it's very interesting that you're questioning these ideas from that same place, same vantage point.
Yeah, I think that when talking about determinism and these specific lines where I talk about, you know, you are the car, you are not the road.
Mm-hmm. What's your line? You are not the driver? Do you also say not the road?
Yeah, okay. It was a difficult metaphor to go with because I really started to think about this metaphor and how to word it exactly. So I eventually went with, you are not, as intuition hints, a driver going along the road.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that if I say you are the car, people will intuit, you know, like, wait a second, no, I'm the driver. Like, the car has a driver. Aha, that's free will. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's a probably not the best metaphor.
It's a real metaphor. It's not a romantic, you know, it's drawn out of real life. It's not a romanticized metaphor that doesn't relate to common experience, right? So I think it's better than the river in terms of just being plain and relevant, you know, and trying to tackle problems of meaning the way we actually live them today.
Yeah, yeah. And I think in the next film in the film that I'm currently trying to edit and everything, I use the metaphor of a movie and an actor, and I think that is a little bit better. It's a bit Shakespearean because Shakespeare said, "We are all actors upon a stage," something like that. So the main point that I was trying to end on is that, as I see it, there are some harmful ideas associated with free will. Blame is one thing, but I also think, you know, pride and ego is another. And so when we get rid of free will, as determinists do, we see that, like, there's no need to blame people for not being adequate, or you know, dare I say, evil. That's not to say that they don't make choices and that they shouldn't be held responsible for what they do, but understanding how they are a product of all of the prior conditions of nature, of nurture. And that should help us make better decisions than this lingering medieval idea of free will. Ultimately, I think it's true, right? I think that there is no free will as such. There's no way that you could have acted differently in a given situation. Even randomness is not free will, right? Because then your actions would not be determined by you. You wouldn't know why you would do the things that you do. So in the script, I think I talk about, you know, without free will, you are free from putting yourself where you are not. And you take on this more kind of universal cosmic perspective that you are a part of everything. That's kind of what I was getting at. I don't blame anyone if they didn't understand that or didn't get that from my words or the writing, because it kind of was secondary to this idea of movement and why I thought it was in some ways harmful. But I will be exploring this idea further in a future film.
Yeah, there's a lot there, and I wonder I think you get to a gracious point of view there, which I wasn't expecting. And it's kind of like, on the one hand, yeah, you're talking about connectedness, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very interesting to be, I think the visual counterpoint is quite rich. On a Good God Talk episode, you know, I remember reflecting that good theology is there for you on your worst day, is, you know, relevant in not unideal circumstances, you know? And I think this is an interesting, it's a context that I've never heard these questions raised, yet it's very much like the way Jesus would have taught and preached. He talked about sheep not because God is necessarily interested in sheep. He talked about sheep because he was talking to shepherds. Mm-hmm. You know, is grounded in people's, his audience's, his original audience's real day-to-day experiences. And yeah, so on the one hand, you're talking about connectedness and context for grace, potentially in the sense of like forgiveness and understanding and compassion. And it's not necessarily saying you shouldn't try to do your best, but it's a context for saying, it's a perspective that you can only maybe you have more clearly retrospectively, right? And also for looking at others, it can be a context that allows us to assume that everyone is always doing their best. Not saying that that's your view necessarily, but it's a worldview, it's a philosophy that would allow for that.
I guess I would phrase it differently. I see what you're saying, and then yes, depending on how that's defined.
I just say, I think that matters because I think free will, I think you may choose different terms if you reflect on this, because I think these specific terms do have to do with very specific baggage. That's a discourse between the Bible and, you know, ancient Greece. And, you know, I think we're interested in freedom and meaning.
Yes.
So I don't know if we, and that specific term free will has its own legacy.
Yeah. 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 I guess you would find yourself in, a lot of agreement with a philosopher like Dennett, who, as I said, is a compatibilist and would argue similar ideas, right? About about the meaning of free will, what is important about free will, choice, and so on. I think someone like Sam Harris, who has argued with Dennett about free will, says something like he's not focusing on what people think free will really is. Sam Harris would say something like, people feel like, they feel like two things that are two sides of the same coin. One, they feel like they are an actor in a movie of their lives, and they also feel like with every choice they could have done otherwise, right? If you were to rewind the clock to that situation where they could have chosen whatever the choice is, however inconsequential or consequential, however significant or insignificant, whether it's to drink water right now or to marry a person or not, that they could have done otherwise if they just rewind everything to that exact moment when they made the decision. And I think what Sam Harris says is, it's a determinist materialist view of the universe. It's just that, well, no, technically speaking, you could not have done otherwise. Rewinding the clock would mean rewinding everything, all of the prior conditions to exactly your brain state, the way that it was. And even if there's some random fundamental element of the universe, as quantum mechanics says, I guess, although that doesn't manifest in the macroscopic world, as far as I know, not an expert in this.
Long-term weather prediction, I believe that is still viewed as impossible.
Okay.
Do you know if that's true? Because I haven't read about this in a decade.
That sounds roughly correct. I mean,
okay, so that might be a comparable to the notion of randomness in quantum mechanics. Yeah, in the microscopic. Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. But I don't know whether that's true or not. And, you know, I do think that some things that look maybe not determined are much harder to understand how they are determined. Mm-hmm. Max Tegmark has this really interesting idea of the mathematical universe, that the fundamental nature of reality is mathematical. Fundamentally, that we can understand the universe, but that the reason it's not a widely held view is that we just haven't gotten to the point where we understand everything, right? So quantum mechanics doesn't work with general relativity, but that's not because there's some supernatural element there. It's because the problem's just much more difficult than we can handle at the moment. So
okay, my head's exploded a few times.
This is hard. This is hard stuff. I'm with you.
But I can see now how both of those key dialogues are being engaged in the work. So that's one harvest of the discourse for me.
I would love to have another conversation about free will with you. The film I'm working on is more explicitly about free will, about this determinist view, and kind of inspired by the book or the essay that I referenced on having no head. So, oh, wait till you hear the title of my working title for the film. It's called Decapitated.
Wow.
So it'll be fun. It'll be fun.
Cool. I thought immediately of Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, but
it's Washington Irving, right? But I think it's a text probably be interesting to look at, because I never thought of the Headless Horseman as having any connection. I just thought of it being kind of random, you know, oh, it's scary, right? But the Headless Horseman is in the same narrative as Ichabod Crane, right? And Crane has been in this long sleep, you know, right? So it's something about, yeah, there are themes there. I never thought about them being related before.
Well, yeah, I know about these stories, but I haven't, I'm embarrassed to say, as an English major, I still haven't read those.
And you live on that land also that Sleepy Hollow is about. So it's another reason.
Wait, what?
I mean, it's about it's about Southern New England. It's about that interstitial between New York City and New England, that space.
Okay, now I understand. Okay, there are multiple ways of interpreting that. This was a lot of fun. Determinism. Yeah. Free will be discussed in the future, but
I feel like we have no choice.
I mean, it's already determined.
Yeah. yeah. That's debatable.
Denise. Yes.
All right. Well, all right. Thank you, Jim. This is intense, and we're not responsible for any heads that explode,
including our own.
Indeed.
Al andar, amigo.
Al andar, pa'lante. Gracias.